You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy and the Social Question, 8 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 7th of March, 1919. There is a curious paragraph in the lecture which Kurt Eisner gave recently to the Basel Students Association. He starts with the odd question as to whether the current state of humanity as we experience it is a reality, or whether it might not be merely a dream, whether our human experience nowadays might be a kind of dreamed reality. The paragraph in question runs as follows, quote, "Am I mistaken, or is my vision clear and true, that there is deep in our existence a longing, seeking to come to light, that the life we are compelled to live today might be only the invention of some evil spirit? Imagine, if you will, a great thinker who knew nothing of our era, and who lived around 2,000 years ago. Imagine he had dreamt how the world might appear in 2 millennia. With the liveliest possible imagination, he could not have conceived of a world such as the one we are now condemned to live in. What exists is in reality, after all, the only utopia, and what we desire, what lives in our minds as longing, is the deepest ultimate reality. Everything else is a ghastly specter. We confuse dream with waking. Our task is to shake off this old dream of our modern social existence. Just look at the war. Can we conceive of a human mind that could have dreamt up such a thing? If this war has not been what we call real, perhaps we have been dreaming and are now waking up. We are a society in which human beings, despite their railways, steam engines, and electric lights, still only perceive a small part of this planet upon which we have been born." Close quote. That was the feeling to which Kurt Eisner gave expression in Basel shortly before he died. Thus today the nature of reality forces us to ask whether we are awake or only dreaming. Is this reality of ours real at all? And actually it would be very good if people today could ask this or similar questions more often, more extensively. You see, it is vital that people should be able to perceive reality in everything that they encounter in the world around them. We have emphasized in various ways how important it is no longer to view what the world needs, what society in particular needs, only in terms of the old habits of thought, acquired over the past few centuries, through to our own time. A clear view of things will show us that these very habits of thought have led us into catastrophe. In cultivating them, people often consider themselves to be pragmatists, and yet they take their point of departure from the grimmest abstraction, then seek to make such abstractions reality. But precisely because these habits of thought have flowed into and given rise to the reality that has been created, it has gradually become an unreal configuration, incapable of sustaining life. We live within this social context, true enough, and regard it as our reality, but it has no real life-giving powers. These are things that cannot be strongly enough accentuated today, and which must be clearly stated by all who look realities squarely in the face. Such facts and realities, albeit initially unfolding only in the daily outer world, speak to us in a way that clearly demonstrates how healing of modern conditions can only come through impulses from the world of spirit. What has grown alien from the spiritual world in recent centuries, running its affairs, if you like, without any account of the world of spirit, now finds itself in a cul-de-sac from which it cannot get out again. And to keep thinking that one can pursue business as usual with the same methods that drove us into this catastrophe is a kind of mindlessness. What have we witnessed, after all? We have seen a humanity that believed it had created the highest material civilization. Think back to how comfortable things appeared before August 1914. Recall how easily we could travel back and forth from one country to another, as long as we were members of the class and culture that could afford such things. Recall how easy it had become to communicate across national boundaries by telegraph and telephone with the furthest flung places in the world. If we think of everything that humanity called civilization, and then of what has become of it in Europe since August 1914, and the conditions we are now living in today, it will be fairly apparent, won't it, my dear friends, that the one and the other are connected, that our present conditions were really implicit in the, in quotes, comfortable, in quotes, civilized way we lived until August 1914. As I put it in the Vienna lecture that I gave before the war, this sickness was already present then as a social cancer, a carcinoma in human society. It ought really to be acknowledged that at a time when things are still so civilized and comfortable, when everything seemed to flatter human desires, as long as people's social class and status gave them the means to pursue them, spiritual science was already elaborating a clear view of reality that had to be expressed as a sickness in society. We were living already in a sick, not a healthy society. We had long been offering a cure for this sickness in the form of an anthroposophic way of thinking. And indeed, the only cure will be to recognize that anything that does not seek this mode of thinking with its receptivity to real spirit will be more or less just charlatanism. We have to pour reality again into what humanity is at present only dreaming. Where shall we find it? It is not found in what the pragmatists draw their ideas from. It is present only where spirit is perceived. And it is this that must be the source of principles and impulses that can flow into society. And so we must always point to this context, this interconnection of things. In the context of these lectures, I have often mentioned the name of Fritz Mautner to you. He published 2 volumes, which he entitled Dictionary of Philosophy, and there classified modern thinking under a series of headings, listed in alphabetical order, along with his own distinctive brand of sometimes vitriolic critique. He writes there, among other things, of the state, the res publica. Fritz Mautner arrived by his own process of thinking at a kind of answer about what the state actually is. He formulates this definition in nothing more. Quote, the state is a necessary evil. Close quote. People can't deny its necessity, you see, but it has become apparent to some that the social structure we nowadays call the state ultimately has led to the conditions in which we now live. And so they call it a necessary evil, since its dire character, in its modern form, is apparent to them. But we must now ask how we might arrive at a positive idea of the state, as opposed to this merely negative one. If someone highlights the negative, we should try to point to the positive, to something affirmative, shouldn't we? So if someone says the state is a necessary evil, he is offering us the negative opposite of something, and we can try to discover what this positive something might be. And here, spiritual science shows us a very remarkable fact. We only understand the state, don't we, when we gain insight into the legal structure that holds sway in it, and the way conditions of ownership, labor, and so on, are regulated. And when we then compare and contrast this legal edifice with something else. My dear friends, in my various books and lectures, you have become acquainted with the world of spirit, with relationships that unfold in the spiritual world, in the periods we pass through between death and a new birth. And the question is this: in what way do these soul relationships between death and a new birth relate to the legal conditions that are established on the physical plane within the social state? To this question comes the reply that the structure of the state is the precise opposite of human relationships in the world of spirit. And this can give us a true picture of the state. People who are quite unaware of the world of spirit cannot gain any picture of the state either, since they have nothing but negative definitions and regulations about interpersonal relations. Positive definitions are the ones that arise when one soul relates to another in the spiritual world. If with this in view, you read the chapter in my book Theosophy about the soul realm, you will discover that a certain kind of regulation of soul-to-soul relationships occurs there, and continues also into what we can call spirit land. And you will see that these relationships are governed by forces that pass between souls, and which can be termed the interaction of sympathy and antipathy. In this chapter in Theosophy, you will see how sympathy and antipathy bring about a certain relationship between one soul and the other in the world of spirit. You will see that in the spiritual world all depends on inwardness, that is, on what works between souls through the forces of sympathy and antipathy. On the physical plane, the workings between souls of the forces of antipathy are concealed by human corporeality. And because of this, because the true essential relationship between one soul and the other is hidden here on the physical plane, in the sphere of the state on the physical plane, the most outward conceivable thing must happen: legal regulation. Whereas our account of the world of the spirit must speak of an unfolding of the most inward powers of the soul, what can live in the state on earth can only be the most externalized aspect of interpersonal relationships. This state is not healthy if it tries to establish anything other than the most externalized legal relationship. For this reason, anything that does not involve the most externalized legal relationship between one person and another must be excluded from state jurisdiction. And the sphere of spirit, administration of cultural affairs, must stand in opposition and contrast to the true sphere of the state, thus defined, and in turn also to purely economic activity, the third member of the social organism. Whereas the state per se represents the complete opposite of the world of spirit, our life of spirit and culture, as I explained before from a different perspective, is a kind of perpetuation of what we experienced in the real spiritual world before we descended into earthly life at birth. What we experience here in religion, education, art, science, and so forth, as well as the connections we develop in this sphere with other people, is the earthly perpetuation, though only a reflection, a mere mirroring, of our actual spiritual life prior to birth. Our economic activity, by contrast, that involves us in what is usually called our material life, is, in fact, the cause and origin of much that we will experience after we cross the threshold of death, thus in life after death. But the state has no relationship with the life of spirit, being the precise opposite of it. And so, if we wish to understand the present age with its dire realities, we must learn to see how necessary it is to take account of spiritual realities in order to gain insight into external reality. Antipathy and sympathy work together in the world of spirit. The antipathies we still retain in the world of spirit when we descend again to earthly existence at birth, and what we must still work through because of these antipathies we retained in the spiritual world, come to expression here as spiritual culture. As human beings, we learn to understand each other through speech, and by this means, in a sense, to forge a spiritual bond between ourselves and others. Because by understanding speech, we must overcome certain antipathies that we brought with us from the spiritual world. We learn to speak to one another in certain ideas, to have thoughts in common in a shared art, a shared religious confession. In doing so, we overcome certain antipathies that we had for one another in the world of spirit. And in economic life here, too, we learn to be dependent on one another, to work for one another, to exchange benefits for benefits with each other in economic activity. And by this means we lay the foundations for certain sympathies which should unfold in the life after death between souls whose ordinary karma has not already created a bond of attraction here. But it is so hard for us to accustom ourselves to this that in respect of the life of culture, it becomes necessary for us gradually to come to understand a whole new language. Really, people would like the old languages to go on being spoken. They think it will be all right if they continue to speak the old kind of language. There are unctuous prophets who propound their outlooks today. I have spoken before about such an outlook. A figure, for instance, who is highly regarded in our time, tells us that this world war showed how people live in a kind of external organization, but without inwardly getting close to each other. And so this war has, he says, produced a throwback to the old barbarism. And to save us from this barbarism, he offers us what you might call feeling phrases that tell us to return to a sort of inner life of spirit. But this is not what is needed today, dear friends. It is no good urging people to become good Christians again, to learn to love their fellow men and forge an inner bond between each other. It is much more important to develop a power of spirit that enables us really to master outward conditions, to give external circumstances a real structure, so that the social order comes to life, becomes life-sustaining. If we are really honest, we cannot say that people today are ailing, first and foremost, because they do not believe in the Spirit. There are enough people who do. And actually every village has its little church, where, I imagine, there is much talk of the Spirit. Even those who oppose the Spirit have a certain respect for it. It is still second nature for people to speak of the Spirit in some way or other. People like Anzengruber, who says, quote, "I swear by God in heaven that I am an atheist," close quote, are by no means so uncommon, whether or not they put it quite like that. But whether or not people speak of the Spirit or even believe in it is not the thing that matters. What is important is that the Spirit should work in and through all material life, so that people recognize that matter can never exist without Spirit. Now, we could cite a great many more variations on this theme of the relationship as perceived today between material life and spiritual life. Basically, people have the feeling that to embrace the Spirit, one must turn one's back on outward material existence. Ultimately, this is connected with the fact that in modern times we have so many ruptured lives, so many people who are dissatisfied with daily life. My dear friends, I am not speaking of you particularly. But nevertheless, I'll say this. There is nothing uninteresting in life as long as a healthy social organism exists into which a person can integrate himself in accordance with his karma. Really, no one in the world has any reason to regard a particular current in life as being less valuable than any other. But we must heal the social organism so that the lowliest laborer is as connected with a life of culture and spirit as someone who, by chance, is able to employ himself in spiritual concerns. It does the greatest injury to modern society to have closed circles within which special interests develop, which are more or less unavailable to others. Try to gain a sense of how in our era closed groups have formed in religion, art, and everything else in middle-class life, and how proletarian circles are excluded from all this. Yes, the ruling classes arrange, in quotes, public events for them, found, in quotes, workers' cultural institutes, and so on. But what is dispensed in this way has arisen from the sensibilities of the middle classes. If the proletarian is to embrace them, he embraces a lie, since only what issues from shared experience can create a shared life of culture. There is no common shared experience if one person has to stand for 8 hours a day at his machine or conveyor belt, as you see, I'm already assuming an 8-hour day, while someone else can construct himself a social and cultural life within his privileged class, and then let crumbs fall from his table for the worker when the latter finishes his 8-hour stint. Little remnants of things whose inmost structure and configuration can really only be understood by someone who belongs to the ruling classes. Within these ruling classes, it is possible to speak, to take a concrete example, of the Sistine Madonna, because these people have a certain basic education. I have led groups of workers around in galleries and was able to see for myself what a lie it is to present to the modern laborer something resembling the feelings which the modern middle classes can have in response to such a painting. This just can't be done. But if you try to anyway, all that you're doing is creating a lie, since there is no common shared life between the classes. And where there is none, you can't speak in a language that both will really understand. The ruling classes have until now been destined to gain something, say in art, which can take root in their whole feeling about life. Through the whole way in which humanity has lived and evolved hitherto, something like the Sistine Madonna has become a gift to and for the ruling classes, remaining initially incomprehensible to the others. So here we first have to look for a language that both can share. That is, we must first make efforts to find a really universally human life of education and culture. And our schools and universities are, of course, far removed from such universality. It will not be enough to realize something that is so often sought, a comprehensive education. It will be necessary to teach in a quite different way from how children are taught today. That is, in a way that can only come about within a free life of spirit and culture as a sphere of the healthy social organism. You see, in his deepest core, the proletarian does not understand what is taught nowadays in general education. You will find a contradiction here, and will be right to do so. You may well say that in comprehensive education, all are equal. So why shouldn't the working classes understand what is taught as well as the middle-class child? Actually, the middle-class child doesn't really understand any of it either, for our whole teaching system is so unhealthy that really none of what is taught there is understood. And only some, specifically those who belong to the ruling classes, are rich enough to get to higher education, where these high schools and universities cast a shadow back on elementary education, so that these students then understand what they learned when they were younger. Those who have no chance to cast a shadow backward on what they learned previously will have no means of absorbing anything from the schooling they received, a schooling that lives among us today as a kind of dreamed reality. These things are typical of the grave nature of our times, of the situation we find ourselves in. Isn't it quite apparent, therefore, that only a new life of spirit, a new culture, can help us? Try for a moment to appraise things honestly in one or another field. Take art, for instance, developments in the last few decades in the art world and in understanding of art. Try for a moment to form a picture in your mind of how people have been speaking about art, what artists themselves have been saying about how one ought to paint or sculpt, and so forth, and what view critics then express about these painters and sculptors. If you try to trace all this and then describe it to the manual laborer who stands 8 hours at his machine every day and is supposed to listen to you lecture him on the subject, he will think it's garbage, meaningless. What is real to him is only that he sees from afar a life that the others enjoy, from which he is excluded, antisocially so, and which he cannot therefore perceive as being part of a life of human dignity. For him, it is all only privileged luxury. But let's look at this in detail, dear friends. It is not as if I want to condemn anything. I'm only characterizing. It's all understandable. But let's examine the shoots sprouting from this comfortable, middle-class order of society up to 1914. I myself witnessed this in the 1880s, when, for instance, the Viennese school was modeling itself on new departures in art that had begun in Paris. Its adherents composed endless verses, did all in their power to get dark rings round their eyes, wandered about in lofty thought on the streets, and praised the merits of La Décadence. They declared that they would only sleep in a room pervaded by the heady aroma of the tuberose. And drawing on all this refinement, they discussed the most elegant form for their verses. I am not condemning these phenomena. It expressed one aspect of humanity in somewhat extreme form, but what issued from this ultimately could only appear as privileged luxury to a great number of people today. Inevitably, it did not strike them, at least, as necessary to a humane existence. Everything ultimately depends on what pulses in human souls, and the way in which human souls can enter into life, how they can live and move there. What came to expression at that time was actually a social carcinoma, the outbreak of disease. These things must teach us that reality will not allow us any longer to express ourselves in the old outmoded ways, and that we must learn a new language. Isn't it palpably clear, my dear friends, that we must now seek something universally human? People will not immediately grasp the degree to which our building expresses this universally human quality, but that is what we have attempted to express with it. It should contain nothing that interests only the privileged classes, or that the proletarian cannot make head or tail of. Despite calling on people's highest spiritual nature, what we have attempted here is something absolutely, universally human. Yes, it is imperfect in many ways, and there are still middle-class aspects to it, but overall, and primarily, what we have tried to do here is universally human. Its forms, albeit drawn from the spirit, are something comprehensible to any and every human being. It can be understood from a living point of view. It is true that because people bring their own particular perspectives, when they come here, we have to talk to them about the building in diverse ways. And yet, it is possible, nevertheless, to show to the simplest, most primitive sensibility what is trying to speak from the forms or other aspects of our building. Similarly, in every field of life, efforts must be made to leave the old behind and speak a new language, to see how the old modes of thinking are what led us to catastrophe. Look, people often regard modern socialism with horror and compare it, say, with the spirit of the Sermon on the Mount, which teaches that the meek and poor in spirit can come to a new world order not through class conflict, but through love. I am not making this up. These are things expressed by very well-known sermonizers. In recent weeks, such things have been expressed countless times. Just a couple of days ago, someone in Bern was saying that we should return to the pure spirit of Christianity, to the spirit of the Sermon on the Mount, as opposed to that of modern class warfare. He went on to regret that the spirit of Christianity had so far been confined to people's private lives, and that it ought to be integrated into political life. Outer public life, he thought, should be Christianized. People come and tell you about this and say, quote, "At last, someone is speaking of the spirit, of how modern humanity can redeem itself from the pitfalls of materialism and return to the spirit of love." Close quote. But the truth, my dear friends, is that people have been saying such things for close on 2,000 years, and it has never helped. They should recognize that we need a new language. But today, people often completely fail to notice the difference between the two languages. They simply do not recognize how radically different it is to propound a life of spirit, a spiritual culture, that seeks to engage fully and directly in the most material reality. This outlook is convinced that matter as such, matter alone, is no reality at all. But that matter should not be despised, since spirit lives in all reality. And where only matter apparently exists, people are just failing to see the spirit. For this reason, we must also be clear about the urgent need today to develop a spirit that really masters reality, that can immerse itself in material life, and does not only propose inner contemplation, finding the God within, developing the source of love. It is thought that this will enable us to find a way from the state of modern society to one where people have deep inner affinity with each other. But no. Today we have to find a spirit, a language, a Christianity that do not expound ethical and religious matters alone, but that are so strong in spirit that the spirit becomes able to encompass the most prosaic and mundane of things, that through this spirit we can say what ought to happen, to find the path of healing, that leads us out of the cataclysms of capitalism, out of the indignity of seeing human beings only as a workforce, and so on. While people have a sense of what is wrong with the social organism, what makes it sick, they cannot fathom the underlying problems. The harm done by money, in small ways and great, is generally recognized. on a small scale, many see that they do not have money. The old serenity, which accepted how things were with a shrug of the shoulders, has come to an end. This was summed up in proverbs such as, quote, "One man holds the purse, but the other has the money," close quote. People now reject such quietism. They observe the injuries of various kinds caused by the economic system, even if they don't get to travel abroad much anymore. Yes, peace has been concluded, but they cross borders less than they could during the war. Yet they see that a mark is worth so much in another region and so much less where they live. The currency question is connected with the whole money issue. So people notice that something is wrong with money, both on a large and a small scale, and that this relates to the most everyday human circumstances. And they ponder on how the harm done might be remedied a little, but they fail to see the need to move on from ordinary external thoughts closely connected to circumstances to far deeper and more primary levels of thought. Certain primary ideas underlie all human institutions. And when human life leads these institutions gradually ever further away from their originating ideas, these archetypes of thought withdraw into human interiority and become feelings and instincts and express themselves in ways in which we can immediately recognize an archetypal character. The social demands that are surfacing today express the reaction of these primary thoughts to human circumstances in society. And people who model their ideas very closely on social circumstances today are the worst fantasists. For all the demands of the proletariat are in fact masked and concealed feelings rooted in primary thoughts. These primary ideas include the separation of spiritual life, the political life of the state, and economic life as we have proposed it. It is toward this that people's instincts tend, and will not rest until some headway has been made in this direction. The grave crisis in which we live today shows how far we have grown distant from primary, originating ideas. Everything else will be shallow quackery, even when dealing with the most external, most material issues. Take money, for instance. Economics professors grandly ask what money is, and there is much debate about it. Is money a commodity or merely a token of value? Some think it's just one commodity among others, and as such can be traded on the market like other goods. That it is a commodity with the convenience of avoiding various conflicts that you would otherwise have in a modern economy. Imagine you're a carpenter or joiner in a world without money. You have to eat. You need vegetables, cheese, butter. But as a carpenter, you make tables and chairs. You take these to market and have to try to sell your wares. Let's say, trade a chair for sufficient food or exchange a table for the clothes a tailor has made. What a fuss and bother this would be. Actually, this is exactly what happens, really, masked only by the fact that we have a generally accepted commodity, money, which we can trade everything for and which can then be held until we need to trade it for different goods. Thus it seems as if money were only an intermediate article, and many economists, therefore, think money is a commodity. But paper money only exists as a substitute for a commodity, backed up by gold. And countries have found it necessary to introduce the gold standard, gold currency, since the leading economic state today, England, has chosen gold as the sole value standard, trading standard, and the other countries had to follow suit. We now have the situation, therefore, in which this intermediate commodity exists. And the carpenter doesn't have to carry his tables to market, but can sell them to anyone who wants them, getting money in exchange, with which he can then buy his cheese and vegetables. But others say that the nature of money is quite different, since it doesn't matter at all. And practice has to some extent confirmed this. Whether we really own the little piece of gold that is worth so and so much in relation to other goods, or whether it doesn't exist at all, but is instead just some kind of substitute bearing the stamp of a particular value. Our modern paper money bears this value stamp, indicating what it is worth. And there are economists today who think it is irrelevant whether or not the gold corresponding in value to these paper tokens is actually there in the bank. As you may know, there are also countries that only have paper money and no gold in the bank to back it up. Under present circumstances, they too can run their economies in this way. At least you can see from this, and in our domain we must found our views on a purely human perspective, that there are clever people today who regard money as a commodity, and other clever people who think it is just a stamp, a token. So what is it actually? Under present conditions, it is both. It is important to recognize that as conditions are today, it is both at once. That on the one hand, particularly in international trading, money often has the character of a commodity only, for the rest is all credit transfers. What can seriously be regarded as the underwriting of value is trading of gold between different countries. Everything else relies on trust, so that when a certain amount of paper money or bills of draft or such like is supplied from one country to another, the state that furnishes it really possesses the gold that backs it. And that, in other words, the commodity exists, the commodity gold, which is then treated like any other commodity. You give a trader credit, don't you? Irrespective of whether he is selling gold or fish or something else, as long as he has some kind of real asset as financial cover or backing. Thus, on the international market especially, money is a commodity. But the state has got mixed up in this, gradually turning money into something attributed a value, something which with only token value. The one interacts with the other, and the harm done here is due to this. The only feasible remedy is to shift the whole administration of money over to what we have called the third sphere of the healthy social organism, the economic organism, releasing and detaching all finance administration from the political organism. And then money will become a commodity and will have to have its commodity value on the commodity market. This would get rid of that peculiar dependency that exists today, which represents an out-of-kilter relationship between currency values and wages. The odd thing today is that currency values fall when wages rise, so that however much you increase the worker's wages, he gains no benefit from this, since he can't buy any more with his money than he could before on his low wages. If wages increase, and the price of food keeps pace with these increases, or, in other words, currency values become quite different, all the other conditions will make no difference. The only remedy here is to remove administration of this economic asset, too, of money, from the political state, so that the money there is can be administered by the third sphere, the economic sphere of the healthy social organism, so as to create true comparisons of value between one thing and another. Fundamentally resolving society into these three spheres leads at the same time to the solving of such specific problems and the restoration of healthy conditions. This is why we need to return to core, primary ideas today, if we are to have any hope of developing healthy ideas for the social organism. Modern governments are asking what to do about the chaotic nature of currency values. The only answer to this question is this: for heaven's sake, leave it all alone if you are political administrators, and cede the administration of currency and money to the economic organism. Only there can healthy foundations be created for these matters. We really must return to what makes things healthy today. Before the devastating war broke out, we saw the curious fact, due to an international situation unaffected by state taxation levies within countries themselves, that in the international arena, economic life necessarily arose by virtue of and through itself. This held true in the international arena, but not within countries themselves, since there the state extended its structures over economic life. This gave rise to conflicts which can only be eradicated again if we really endeavor to establish threefolding. Then the realities at work in one sphere of the social organism will invariably correct the realities in another, if they need to be corrected. There is no other way forward today than to return to primary ideas, to this practical tripartite structure of spiritual and cultural life, economic life, political life. Only those actually involved in one of these spheres will be able to solve the issues that need solving from one or another perspective. Only when economic activity is conducted by one sphere, democratic rights are administered in another, including the passing of legislation, and in the third, all cultural and spiritual matters are regulated, can we create a healthier social organism? Just as the three spheres work together in the human organism, the head system with the cardiovascular system and with the metabolic system, so the three spheres work naturally together also in the healthy social organism. One sphere interacts with the other. Just as you can get a headache resulting from a stomach problem, because the stomach no longer properly supplies the head, even though the three systems are separate, so in the social organism too, if it is really healthy, one sphere interacts with the other, the economic sphere, say, with the rights sphere, and with the cultural sphere. They interact properly precisely when each is relatively self-contained and autonomous. But this proper and untroubled interaction can only be established if the three spheres are independent from each other, and each is governed and regulated according to its own laws. How, for instance, does spiritual, cultural life and activity interact with economic life? What aspect of the spirit is rightly present in economic life? Do you know? I'll tell you. Capital. Capital is the spirit of economic life. And a great amount of harm existing in our day arises from the fact that the administration of capital, its fertilization and fruitfulness, as it were, is withdrawn from the life of spirit. It is important that in the healthy social organism, the relationship between, let's say, the manual worker and the person or group that organizes this work with the aid of capital is seen as one of mutual trust only, founded on reciprocal understanding, in the same way, say, that we can have a free choice of school for our children. In the healthy social organism, the employer or entrepreneur can no longer live in a world apart from the employee. Today the laborer operates his machine or stands at his conveyor belt and is involved in nothing more than these operations. And only outside the factory gates is he free to follow other pursuits. The employer, in turn, has his own life and circles, I described them to you before, which may involve various forms of decadent pursuit. The employer pursues cultural life that is separate and distinct from the rest of society. Yet we urgently need a kind of spiritual cultural life that does not divide manual workers from mental workers, and then capitalism will have a social foundation. Not of a kind suggested by modern fantasists, but one that makes it possible for each individual worker to be connected culturally with all those who organize his work and who in turn conduct the product of his work back into the social organism or even into the whole world. Just as important as the worker's labor is, that business matters are discussed at regular meetings between the employer and an employee, so that the latter continually has an overview of what is happening. This is something we must endeavor to establish for the future. The employer should be required at any moment to tell the employee exactly what is happening and discuss all its details with him, so that the factory or company is embedded in a shared culture. That's the important thing. Only then is it possible to establish the kind of relationship which will enable the worker to say, quote, "Yes, he is as necessary as I am, for without him my labor would get nowhere in the social organism. He directs my work to the right place." Close quote. And likewise, the employer will have to actually do this and accord the worker what is due him, for everything will be transparent. Here you see, dear friends, how the life of spirit must play into the workings of capitalism. Anything else is just so much bluster, just fantasy. A healthy relationship between work and capital cannot be established by some kind of social bureaucracy, but only through a shared culture, in which someone who has the individual gifts and capacities to do so in this field, that is, to work as a capitalist, can also be really productive, can make his individual skills fruitful for the healthy social organism, in the process eliciting the free understanding of the manual laborer. Thus, understanding can arise for initiatives driven by individual capacities, for in the free life of spirit, these will be intrinsically socially beneficial. They only have an antisocial tendency today because we are caught up in the unnatural conditions. Socialization must be founded on the free initiative of individual capacities and on the free understanding that is brought to bear on what these capacities achieve. Nothing else will work. Anything else is charlatanism. It ought to be possible to see the truth of what I say here simply by observing the symptoms apparent in the social organism. My dear friends, consider for a moment that there are things in the world about which people can and do hold extremely diverse views. Whereas anyone will tell you that a loaf of bread will feed someone when he's hungry, and no one will dispute this, a world view is quite another matter. Some will consider it true, others false. And however true it may be, it will get nowhere because of this. We can argue about such matters in the realm of culture, things of the spirit, but there is no dispute about the realities of economic life. Why is this? It is because the spirit has become ideology, no longer working as a reality, but only as a secondary adjunct to economic life and political life. If founded on itself, it becomes necessary for this sphere to reveal its own reality to the world, and then reality will simply radiate from it. But then, of course, it will not merely figure in the idle loquaciousness of moral sermonizers, not simply figure in the speeches of those who tell us we should be good Christians and so on, as they vaunt all kinds of virtues, but stop short before material realities. A bridge must be built between this abstract form of the Spirit and the Spirit that is really worthy of the name, which works, for instance, within capital, for it is capital that organizes labor. But this organizing activity must really be governed and administered by the spiritual sphere. So on the one hand, in practical terms, financial administration must be left to economic life, while on the other hand, work organized by capital should be governed by the life of spirit. And here you see the cooperative interaction of things that outwardly appear to be one. For, of course, capital is represented in the factory in monetary terms. But the relationship between employee and employer, this whole relationship of trust, the fact in particular that an employer or entrepreneur operates in a particular place, is organization issuing from the sphere of spirit. Whereas the value of a particular commodity in monetary terms is organized in economic life. And these things flow together in the same way that in the human organism the outcome or yield of each of the three systems flows together to maintain the health of the organism. Thus you can enter into tangible realities, the most mundane circumstances of life. And you will see that what we have flagged up here with really primary ideas, archetypes, that must sustain the healing of the social organism. The end of Lecture 6.